Yeah, Jerry, thank you for your prayers for our covert mission, I guess you could call it. Small church in Sydney. There's only two Bible believers that I know of in the Sydney area. This one was started by a fellow named John Wheat. John or Jim? I always forget. John, I think. He was an early graduate of PBI years and years ago. I think he won Ben Smoker to Christ. If not, he discipled them. And so last time we were there, they had probably 30 or 40, but they were probably 90% Filipinos. And Brother Paul, who's actually running the place now, he's not the pastor, but he said that some Filipino coerced the other Filipinos to go to a Filipino church. They lost a lot of them. So they're down to about 12 to 15. And so it's a blessing to be able to preach for them. And I know Brother Paul really appreciated it. Give him a break. Because if you're a deacon and not called to preach, it is kind of hard. And so it's a place where Heidi wants to live near so she could be in a good church. And when they knew she played a piano, they begged her to play the piano. Of course, she didn't even hesitate. She just loves to do something for the Lord. So we're praying that there's a possibility of an apartment close there. I say an apartment. In that country, things are out of sight on prices. Out of sight. So, like a motel here, what? A cheap motel here is $50. You know, $50 you can get by. A cheap motel there is $115 a night. And downtown, they were $150, $175 a night. And so it's a killer on you. And the Aussie dollar is more than a U.S. dollar now. 4 years ago, it was 70 cents to a 70 cents for an Aussie to a U.S. dollar one. Now it's a dollar is a dollar five in Aussie. So you just got to deal with that. So we're in 1 Samuel 17. This is a famous story, obviously. This is often a Sunday school story. Many kids growing up in church know this story of David and Goliath. Used to be that most everybody in America knew that. A few years back, I was in visiting guys in jail, and I happened to mention this story in the Bible about David and Goliath, and one guy said, "David and Goliath, I don't know that story." 20 years old. And then he goes, "Oh yeah, I remember that. Goliath the dog." And I didn't know what he was talking about, and I realized that's a cartoon on TV. Can you imagine a 20-year-old living in America doesn't even know the story of David and Goliath? The cartoon, yeah. Yeah. So this story of David and Goliath, it's pretty easy to understand as far as we go through it. The story is well known. For a long, long time, I often thought that David was probably nervous getting in this fight. But the more you think about it, would you be nervous to get in a fight if somebody on the other side had a knife and you had a 9mm? Only if it jammed. You know? And so David had a 5mm. He had 5 rounds with him. And he could hit distances. A revolver. His was a revolver, yeah. Yeah, that's right. It wasn't going to jam. His only fear probably bouncing off the guy's head. It's so hard. So, this is the story of David and Goliath. And it's obviously with kids, you don't mention how did this guy get so big. That's never mentioned. You know, obviously you don't want to mention that with kids, but you don't really mention it even with adults. How did this guy, what was this guy, this Goliath? Anybody that reads the Bible a little bit will say he's about 9 feet, 9 inches tall. If you go with a cubit at 18 inches from here to here, a span being 9 inches from here to here, but often cubits are measured by whoever is running the country. And if he was the top guy or up there, his cubit would have been larger. So this guy most likely was at least 10 feet tall, more like 11. So he's a big dude. The bulls would love to have him. Okay, so chapter 17, verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered together the armies to battle and were gathered together at Shoco, which belongeth to Judah, pitched between Shoco and Ezekah in Ephrath Damim or something like that. Okay, just a place where they're at. Philistines in the Bible are what we call modern-day Palestinians. Technically, biblically, Palestinian is a Jew, but the modern-day news media thing is somebody who lives in Palestine, the Gaza Strip. Okay, that's who it is, so we can see that nothing has changed. Philistines or the Palestinians still hate the Jews. Nothing's going to change that fact until the Lord comes back, and it's still they're still going to hate them. Verse 2, and Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah and set the battle in array against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, and there's a valley between them. So it's obviously the advantage militarily is to be high up. Okay, and so whoever's on the mountain going down, that's who usually wins the battle. Except when God is in control, so Saul and Jonathan the armor bearer went up a cliff and still won the battle because God's in control or God's on their side. So whoever's going to come down in this valley, okay, the way they set it up is you're going to have two guys come down in the valley. Whoever wins, the other one is supposed to yield to the loser or is supposed to yield to the winner, but obviously we know that these Palestinians would believe in Hudna. Hudna is a doctrine of the Islamic faith that if you make an agreement with somebody, the longest it can last is 7 years. And it really doesn't matter you don't make an agreement because, like in communism, a truth is anything that promotes your way. But Hudna is a doctrine that the Muslims have that they don't have to keep their agreements. Okay, and so we see in the story as we read it that the Philistines will not keep their agreements. Verse 4, and there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines. Okay, the Philistines. Let's look at their race. Who are they? Go backwards to Genesis chapter 10, verse 14. This is a funny story in Ruckman's Ad Lib commentaries. Has anybody watched that or listened to his Ad Lib commentaries? He has the case where after David kills Goliath, the Philistines are hightailing out of there, and one of them said, "What are we leaving for?" And the other says, "You see them little boys with them skirts? If they can whoop up on Goliath, I ain't going to stick around." And so that's what they're doing. Genesis chapter 10, verse 14, you see the descendants here. This is the race is laid out in the Bible. This will be the descendants of Ham. Ham will be one of the three boys of Noah. In Psalm, it says that Egypt is the land of Ham. So his sons were Cush, Mitzrayim. Okay, Mitzrayim, another name for Ethiopia. No, Cush is another name for Ethiopia. Mitzrayim is another name for Egypt. Okay, and then Canaan, and then Phut. Okay, and then if you drop down to verse 14, these are the descendants of them. In verse 14, in the parentheses, it says Philistine. So now we see the race we're dealing with. Okay, these would be Hamites. Goliath would come from that race. Named Goliath of Gath. Okay, so he's of Gath. If you look in Joshua 11:22, this is where some giants remained in the land. Joshua 11:22. Joshua 11:22, there was none of the Anakims left in the land of the children of Israel, only in Gezer or Gaza. This is the Gaza Strip. Okay, and then Gath, that's where Goliath was from, and in Ashdod, there remained. So there's his race as far as a man is, but I think there's something else involved with him other than being a man per se. okay, where this guy is a product, most likely, of the Anakims, or like the Anakims. In Numbers 13, verse 33, talks about the Anakims being the giants. Now, Numbers 13:33, if you want to deal with somebody with a new Bible, that's a good one to go to, as well as Genesis 6:4, where the King James Bible is more clear and understandable because it will translate the word giants. The new Bible is in Genesis 6:4 says there were Nephilims in the land. That's real understandable, is it not? The NIV really clears that up for us and really helps us out. The San Francisco Nephilims are going to play the Cubs come, you know, this sometime this year. Okay, so that idea about the new Bible as being clearer, more plain, that can go both ways. Genesis 12, verse 9, it says that Abraham went toward the south in the King James Bible, and all the new Bibles he went toward Negev. So that can come or go. In the Revised Standard in Job 12, it says, in the Bible, it says about, is there any taste in the white of the egg? And the RSV really made that understandable and helpful, and it talks about, is there taste in the slime of purslain? That was real helpful. So that idea of making it clearer, more understandable is, you know, that just depends on the passage you go with. Okay, this story with Goliath. In 1 Samuel 17, this is one of those stories, if you can remember the verses or the references, if you deal with somebody with a new Bible, if you don't remember them, get the Which Bible track. In 1 Samuel 17:51, it has David killing Goliath. In 2 Samuel 21, verse 19, or 19:21, let me see if I get, I think it's 21:19. A fella named Elhanah slew the brother of Goliath. But all the new Bibles take the phrase "the brother of" out, so they have Elhanah killing Goliath. So now you have two separate people killing Goliath. That's one passage I show to people. Ask them who killed Goliath, and then show them in the NIV that another fella did. Okay, and so that's obviously the brother of in the King James Bible is italicized, and this is a problem that those people, you know, the scholars try to figure that out. But yet then if you go to 1 Chronicles, it still says the brother of there. All they had to do is read their Bible. Okay, so 1 Samuel 17, who's this guy named Goliath? Okay, if you take the royal cubit, which is 20.62 inches of the ark, Goliath would have been over 10 feet tall. So he's a big guy. Kent Hovind has down in his Pensacola, Florida, in his little museum, bone skeletons of people that are 11 and 12 feet tall. If you take the bone skeletons that they have, and there are many sites that you can find some of these things that people who believe in evolution don't want to deal with. Okay, prior to the flood, it appears that these people were much taller. Much bigger, not just the giants, but everybody in general. Because the oxygen content was higher, and this is where the dinosaurs came from, because it's nothing but a reptile that continues to grow. So, Ron Wyatt was thinking that Noah and his wife were tall people, 10 and 11 footers, making the giants 20 or 25 footers. Okay, which could be true. You know, we don't know because we don't have all the evidence, but there are some skeletons that reveal very, very large people. Okay, there's a fellow out of Canada, been winning some court cases. I've looked at some of his stuff, and he has some strange pictures on his website. And he's got some of those giant pictures. Somebody excavating and seeing there's a skull as big as the guy almost. And he's got some strange pictures about the North Pole, which, you know, is weird stuff. Okay, so Mr. Goliath was a remnant. He's a remnant of a perverted, sensual, satanic product of fallen angels cohabiting with women and then having a giant. Okay, as in Genesis 6, verse 1 through 4. So this is what I would put in our category of the Bible as a strange doctrine. We know a little bit about it. We can study a little bit about it, but I'm not going to travel around having a ministry about it. There's a guy on the web, if you want to research, a guy named David Quayle, that has spent much of his life studying this stuff. So if he wants to spend his life doing it, that's his choice. I might pick some few things off him and try to do something more, you know, more for God's kingdom. Okay, but that's a good place you could study. And you can see, if you pay attention to the spirit of our age, the spirit of our age is getting people conditioned to these things. You know, especially the kids with their cartoons. You know, on the flight from San Francisco to America, I sat a little Hispanic girl, 6 or 7 year old, sitting next to me, sitting and watched the monsters and the Pokemon and just all that stuff, just getting in them kids' head. So Goliath is a weird character. Okay, he had a helmet of brass upon his head. Okay, well, okay, verse 4. There went a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Okay, if it's an 18-inch cubit, that's 9 feet, span 9 inches, that's 9 foot 9 incher. That would be the shortest the guy would be. Probably had 6 fingers on each hand. You could really palm a basketball. Okay, because there, you go to the cross references, there were like that, there were men like that. Verse 5, and he had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. So I guess he's going postal. That's what this guy's doing. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. I forgot to look up shekels. How much is a shekel? Does anybody know how much that weighs? You can run the math and see how heavy this is. It's no doubt very heavy. He had greaves of brass upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders. The staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam. And his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. And one bearing a shield went before him. So he had his armor bearer in front of him. And then he had this heavy equipment on him. Okay, and then it says, and he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, why are ye come out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine, and ye servants to Saul? Notice the arrogance. Servants to Saul. You people don't think for yourself. You're just under your king. And that's exactly what they are. Okay, technically servants of the Lord, but okay, servants to Saul, but yet in reality, yes, servants to Saul. And then he says, choose you a man for you and let him come down to me. If he be able to fight with me and to kill me, then will we be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall ye be our servants and serve us. Okay, first rule here as far as war is, why does this guy get to make the rules? Why does he get to make the rules? There's no rules in war. The rule in war is to win. Of course, we know that that's not the rule in war in our country. On the way back, I read on the plane, you know, I started reading it right before I left, and then I wanted to wait because I knew I was going to read the whole thing on the plane. Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Gene Zimmerman's mentioned that book. Has anybody read that beside myself, Brother Jeremy? Confessions of an Economic Hitman, it will change your whole entire outlook on foreign policy and how war is caused in our country. This guy was an economic hitman. So he's describing his life.
My phone here says a shekel.
A shekel, 600 pounds? That, yeah, that couldn't be. Is it just for one shekel?
I wrote in there, how much did the shekel weigh? 600 shekels.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah. Yeah, that'd be 600 shekels times 600. That's too much. Okay, so... Many generals will study a guy named Sun Tzu as far as the art of war. Okay, but And so, as mentioned, the Confessions of an Economic Hitman book ought to be read. Okay, just great book to reveal what actually is going on throughout the world. And, you know, actually, you know, thank God I'm not responsible for these things, and I'm not going to be held accountable for what our presidents or congressmen do. Now, I often hear people say America's going to be held accountable. I don't buy into that. Well, you voted him in office. How do you know we did? And still, if you vote a guy in office, don't mean you're accountable to him. If you vote for a pastor, okay, the folks that voted for Jack Scop to be their pastor in Hammond, are they accountable for what he did? No, they're not accountable for that. He's accountable for himself. George Bush is accountable for himself. Obama's accountable for himself. I'm accountable for me. And so, but yet, you know, if we know what these people are doing, we can just pray more effectively. Like Elijah prayed against Israel. Okay, and that's what we can do. So Goliath is in this weird realm. And I think we would be surprised if we realize how many of our political figureheads are in this same realm. Strange. They have no emotions about hurting people. None. Okay, it doesn't faze them. And so Goliath is in that realm. So he is making a rule that if we have a battle, if I win, you be our servants. If you win, we'll be your servants. Okay? He lost, and the Philistines did not become their servant. They didn't abide by the rule. Verse 10, and the Philistines said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, those words, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Who was the best candidate to go out and fight him? Mr. Saul. Is that not why they chose him to be king? He would go out and fight our battles. What happened to him? He was the biggest guy. And he may have been one of these weird characters, but who knows? But he was the biggest guy to go out. And he refused to go out. Okay, and this is, you know, often where political figureheads will be arrogant about war, but yet they won't go, or they won't send their children to go. So Saul should have went, but he didn't. And so now we see what, now the story, the camera is going to go to somebody else, as often movies do. Verse 12, now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse. And he had eight sons, and a man went among them for an old man in the days of Saul. And the three eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to the battle. Okay, so they got drafted. Three guys, three oldest boys. The names of his three sons that went to the battle were Eliab the firstborn, next unto him Abinadab, and the third Shammah. And David was the youngest, and the three eldest followed Saul. And David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So, and the Philistine drew near morning and evening and presented himself 40 days. So 40 in the Bible is often used to typify trials and tribulations. Jesus fasted 40 days and things like that. It is a common term or number in the Bible. Okay, and Jesse said unto David, his son, take now for thy brethren an ephah of this parched corn and these 10 loaves and run to the camp to thy brethren and carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their 1,000 lay hold, and look how thy brethren fare and take their pledge. Now, of course, we can't do that today. I mean, who's going to run to a battlefield? Where's the battlefields? Iran, Iraq, you know, Afghanistan? Okay, so, but yet they could do that. So he's following orders of his dad. His dad said, I want you to do this. Verse 19, now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper. Okay, the keeper of the sheep. Okay, there's a good term right there to think about if you run that one throughout the Bible. The keeper, where a wife is a keeper of the home. But yet some thinks that means she's supposed to stay in the house. A keeper of the sheep, is he supposed to keep in the sheep? You know, or a keeper of the wardrobe, is he supposed to stay in a closet? No, it's keeping house. Taking care of household duties and things like that. Okay, he left the sheep with a keeper, so David had his responsibilities covered and took and went as Jesse had commanded him, and he came to the trench as the host was going forth to fight and shouted for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army. And David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage. Now we see the word carriage. Okay, in our mind, we would probably think of a buggy, horse and buggy. But we have to go to the Bible and get the definition. A carriage would be his baggage that you carry. So he had some baggage of some type. He left it in the hand of the keeper of the carriage, ran into the army and came and saluted his brethren. Okay, saluting as in, you know, the hand thing and everything. And as he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of Philistines, and spake according to the same words, and David heard them. Okay, so now he hears this big dude. Yelling, cussing, defying the army of Israel, cussing God. Doing all he can to try to incite somebody to come out and fight him. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, have ye seen this man that has come up? Surely to defile Israel is he come up, and it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches, and will give him his daughter. What if she was uglier than a mud fence? Okay, no way, forget that one. Enrich him with great riches and give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. Okay, free in Israel, tax free, is the idea. That's a term used throughout history in America. Free white in 21. Okay, in Acts 22 or Acts 16, Paul called that free born. Now, give his daughter away. That Oriental mentality. Wouldn't that make the daughter feel kind of, what am I, a pawn or something? But then again, that's Oriental mentality. And they still think like that, especially in the Muslim cultures. So there's the deal. So he can get a bunch of money, enriched, not pay taxes, and then he's got a bride. Okay, and verse 26, and David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killed the Philistine, taking away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him after this manner, saying, so shall it be done to the man that killeth him. And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David and said, why camest thou hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle. Isn't that not typical? Okay, so he's, you know, telling his brother what he thinks of him, and he's, you know, I don't know, he's under conviction probably. Because David has shown some courage. David at this age, who really knows his age, but probably late teens. But he's, you know, maybe the Lord revealed him what's going on. And David is obviously fully confident in his ability to use the sling. He had practiced much with it, very confident with it. But when we see his confidence, we'll see back in verse 46 and 47, his confidence is in the Lord more than anything. But even at that, he has to have had practice with this sling. Verse 29, and this is often, especially the last verse, is used for preaching. And David said, what have I now done? Is there not a cause? And I've heard a lot of preachers preach on that one. Is there not a cause? And so then they go on that, just that one little verse, and they preach about, is there not a cause? And go on and on and on. Which is fine. Good preaching. Okay, if a guy's got that ability to take one phrase and talk about it for an hour. Okay, I don't have that ability. Verse 30, it says, he turned from him toward another, and spake after the same manner, and the people answered him again after the former words. When the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. So he's just appealing. He's appealing to everybody that will hear him. Why doesn't somebody go get this guy? Why doesn't somebody go get him? What's going to happen if somebody does go, well, you get this, this, and this. Yeah, but you know, you get your head cut off, you don't get any of that stuff. Well, I don't think his motive was that. He was mad because this being was mocking his God. Now, under the Old Testament covenant, if somebody mocked the God of Israel, they would have a right to fight them physically over that. They have a right to do that and kill them, being a false prophet. In the New Testament, I don't believe we have that right. And if somebody mocks God, and if you want to hear him mock him, go street preaching when the weather turns better, you'll hear him mock God. Now, sometimes I say things, sometimes I don't. I just say, hey, it's your funeral, not mine. But I don't want to hear it. I'll walk away. We have a God that can take care of himself. And our God has listened to men and satanic beings mock him now for 6,000 years. And when he's had enough, he'll do something about it. And I certainly hope he starts, you know, doing something about it. Okay, but when he's ready to do something about it, he'll do something about it, and we don't have to do a thing. So, he's mad about this. David's upset about it, obviously. And so, now, Saul catches wind of this. Verse 32, and David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. So he's got the plan. He knows he's got the sling. He knows his ability to use it. He knows it's not going to jam. Okay, and then Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. For thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. Okay, so you're going to have somebody discourage you. When you are fully confident that God is directing you to do something and somebody discourages you, I don't say don't listen to it. I say listen to it, consider it, because David does consider some things, but then he does follow the Lord's leading. 33, and Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of from his youth, a war from his youth. David said to Saul, thy father kept his father's sheep. There came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock, and I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by the beard and smote him and slew him. So hand to hand with a bear or a lion, that's pretty impressive. And how many scars did he get cut up on that? You know, David was a tough guy. David's a tough guy, but yet he played a harp. And okay, you know, if you go to a harp place and you see people playing harp, it's almost always females. I mean, what's a boy going to do if somebody asks what instrument he plays? He says, I play a harp. The average person is going to... But if they said that to David, he'd say, would you like to go challenge something? My playing of the harp is my love for my God. And a harp, you know, obviously Lindsay does play it, and it's a beautiful sound when they play it right and everything. But David was a tough character. And it is sad that when you listen to classical music, they almost always got a faggy voice type announcer. It discredits the music. It really does a discredit to the music totally. Okay, and we can praise our God and worship our God, men and women alike, in song, and it will bring praise to our God. And so, it's a blessing to see the young people that do play their instruments, the violins and everything, but yet they are also, the boys, will also be running around with their guns. So they have a balance there. You know, as far as what some would say, a lot of times some would feel that the boys are musically in music, they're a little on the sissy side, but that doesn't necessarily have to be true. And it's sad when a boy doesn't want to do that because he has that mentality. And so David was the one who played the harp. And so he is telling about his experiences of killing a lion and a bear. You would tend to think, okay, using a sling on those things, but man, using a sling on a bear, that's a tough shot. Verse 36, "Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing that he hath defied the armies of the living God." And David said, "Moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he would deliver me out of the hand of the Philistine." And Saul said unto David, "Go, and the Lord be with thee." Old Testament phrase, "The Lord be with thee." In the New Testament, he's with us at all times for born-again believers. Now, this is something. We have a lion, we have a bear. And when you go to Revelation 13, you have four beasts, or three beasts mentioned, a lion, a bear, and a leopard. And when all those are put together, they become the beast of the Antichrist. These animals, lion, bear, leopard, typify governing authorities. And the closer we get to Christ's kingdom, the more tyrannical or vicious or violent they become. Okay? And we just have to understand that. And if they want to make it what they think is a Christian to be president, he is still in a field of violence and tyranny, no matter what title you put on it. And we just have to understand that, and that's how life is. So that's Goliath. Verse 38, "And Saul armed David with his armor, and he put an helmet of brass upon his head. Also he armed him with a coat of mail." Now, I don't know why Saul is doing this. Saul is a big guy. Would he be putting too big of armor on David? Obviously it would have to be too big. But in Saul's mind, this is the only way to go fight. 39, "And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off him." Now, there's a good statement. I have not proved this. I have not used something like this. I don't know how to work with this. This is something I have not used. I don't know how this is going to work. I have a method that it worked twice before, and it's going to work again. Let me go my route. Now, a lot of times people, as far as in the Christian realm too, we get in a rut where we think something has to be done in this fashion. Okay? And a lot of churches, if they're big on like camp meetings or things like that, they're big on altar calls. Okay? And they're big on that. And they want to see people come down the aisle, and they want to see them on their face, and they think that that's a successful meeting. That doesn't mean anything. It really doesn't. And if somebody has a lack of faith, the Spirit of God can work when we walk away from a service as He can when we're in the service. I've never been one of these where they drag on the song for 50 times to get people to come down the aisle. I remember years ago when we were in Colorado Springs, this Christian school we are part of, they had an 8-man tackle football team. In Colorado Springs or in Colorado on the plains, they would run 8-man tackle football instead of 11 because the schools were smaller. We had 14 boys in the school, 13 were on the team, and we had an 8-man tackle football team. But of that team, 10 of them had been playing the same together from 7th grade up. And now you got one shot, they are good. And they went undefeated in Colorado. We played a public school team and beat them 62-12. You know, and I was running the chains, listening to the coach. He was a sarcastic coach, a public school guy. He said, "Good play, good tackle, too bad you tackled our guy." I mean, he's sitting all this stuff, and I'm just laughing at this guy. We got invited to a camp in Tennessee. It was for like a nationals tournament. Four teams were invited, so we got invited. We went. So this guy, what he did, he'd have these teams come in, four large schools, four small schools, and then he'd run it, and then he'd preach at these kids. So he got all these kids, cheerleaders, players, eight schools in this gymnasium. He's preaching at them, and he's doing some karate demonstration. And so then he has time for invitation. And hardly anybody moved. And so what did he do? All you captains of the football team, stand up. If you want to be a leader in your team, come down here and show how you want to do something for God. Well, what are they going to do? All you cheerleaders, the head cheerleaders, stand up where you're at. You want to be a leader for your school, then show your leadership for your Lord. Come down here. So now what? Now, and then everybody's down. Of about 400 there, there was probably 50 left in the bleachers. Why? They weren't football players. They weren't cheerleaders. They weren't youth leaders. And then this guy is taking pictures of this great revival. And there's one school, it's charismatic school, and all these charismatic kids boo-hoo and hugging each other. Our kids had been used to preaching, used to hard preaching. They stood down there and looked around and said, what is this? I mean, it was a joke. A flat joke is what it was. And, you know, people tend to think, okay, that altar call, that's the way it's supposed to be done. That's not a rule. A lot of people that read Michael Pearl's stuff, would they read his material if they realized he only had church once a week? Sunday morning? I mean, that's all he does. They might have a Wednesday night for a short time, but that's all Mike does. Don't have anything organized for the church. Nothing. That's just how he does it. That's the way he feels it's led to be done. That's the way he does it. And so there's different things that we can do. And the problem with a lot of American missionaries is they go to a foreign culture and they don't try to make these people follow the ways of the Bible. They try to make them to follow the ways of America. And that's what messes it up. And so Paul had this method in his mind, this is how it's supposed to be. And David said, I haven't even proved this. I can't do this. And so he went a different route. Okay, so that's up to 38, 39. We'll pick that up right there and try to finish it off next week. Any questions or comments were we covered? Did you find a shekel the way...